We're doing in Yaakov. We're up to tractate Shabbos, and we're up to page Daf Yud Aleph, the fifth page in the regular editions. Daf Yud Aleph in the regular editions. Rav Yeshua b'Rei Ravidi Ikla lebei Ravashi. Rav Yeshua, the son of Ravidi, came to Ravashi's house. Avdulei, they made for him igla tilta. Igla is like an egel, a calf. Tilta means a third. Now, this is another way of saying they made a very, very prime steak for him. Amru lei litomar midi. So after they prepare this delicious steak in honor of Rav Yeshua b'Rei Ravidi, they say, Rabbi, why don't you taste something? Amar lehu, so he tells them, betanita yativna, I'm fasting. I'm having my own personal fast. Amru lei, they answered him, lo sava leima le'ad Rav Yehuda, don't you hold like Rav Yehuda? Ta'amar Rav Yehuda lo ve'adam tanito pu'er, Rav Yehuda says, if you took on a personal fast, if midday you decide, let me do it on a different day, you could do that. Midday you could say, you know what, I'm going to eat today and fast tomorrow or fast a different day. So you could, so to speak, take a rain check on a fast. We're talking about a personal fast, not a public fast. Person decides for himself he's going to fast. So why don't you do that? We prepared you this great steak. Amar lehu tanit chalomu. He answered them, no, this isn't any ordinary fast. This is a fast over a bad dream. I had a dream I'm worried about. And a fast over a dream you're worried about. We have the following quote. Yafa tanit lachalom ke'esh lenehoret. A fast is good for a bad dream, like fire catches on the thin threads of wool. So that's the idea here. I'm fasting in order to undo a dream I had. And Rav Chisda taught that the fast only works if you fast the morning after you dreamt the dream. So I can't borrow and take a rain check on this fast because I had the dream last night. So I have to fast now. Rav Yosef says, even on Shabbos, if a person had a dream that's really troubling him, and he wakes up in the morning and he's really concerned for the dream, even though ordinarily we're obligated to eat on Shabbat, right? We have to eat three meals. You're not allowed to fast on Shabbos. For this guy, we say his joy of Shabbos is to fast because he's so worried over his dream. So he should fast. So that's why I have to fast today, even though you guys prepared me this great steak. Sorry, guys, I can't eat.
Listen to Kiddush and the Yotze just by hearing it.
I guess you could do that. You could also be Yotze Kiddush and davening. Right? A person, this is quoted in Halacha. If a person ends up fasting on Shabbos, then he has to fast again during the week over the fact that he fasted on Shabbos. That's a funny Halacha, yeah. But today we say that most of our dreams stem from indigestion. We don't fast over our dreams too much. At best, we do a Tavat Chalom, which the Talmud told us in the previous tractate, that you get together three friends, and there's a thing which you say, that the dream should turn out for good. So today it's rare that we'll fast over a dream. We don't take our dreams that seriously. Tana Devei Rabbi Yishmael. We have the following quote from the Academy of Rabbi Yishmael. Yotze Adam B'Tfilin Erev Shabbat Im Chashecha. A person may walk out in the public domain Friday afternoon as the sun is setting. Now, he shouldn't be out with his tefillin on Shabbos. So how come you let him go around so close to Shabbos? You're not concerned that he's walking around with his tefillin. My taima, what's the logic behind this? Kevan da amar Rabba bar Avuna, chayav adam lemashbesh betfilin kol shah v'shah. We were taught by Rabba bar Avuna that a person has to always think of the tefillin he's wearing. Kal v'chomer mitzitz. You know where we know this from? From the tzitz. Who knows what's the tzitz? Tzitz, what's the tzitz? The Kohen Gadol wore a gold piece, like a gold, what's it called?
Crown?
It's like a little crown.
A plate of metal.
It's a plate of metal that went across his forehead. You know, and it's the Kohen Gadol wore it. It was one of his eight garments. So it was made of solid gold, and it said God's name on it. That's why he was never allowed to lift his hand over his head, because God's name was engraved over there. And it says about the tzitz that he's always supposed to think about the tzitz. He's never allowed to take his mind off it. So the Gemara says, even though the tzitz had God's hidden name on it, but nonetheless, ma tzitz shen bo ela azkara achat, the tzitz only had God's name once. It said on it, Kodesh Lashem, sanctified to Hashem. So that's it had God's name written once, and nonetheless, Amrat Torah, the Torah says, Aya mitzchot tamid, should be there forever. The kohen should always wear the tzitz. Really? He goes to sleep, he wears it? He goes to the bathhouse, he wears it? So our sages understood that when it means it should be on his forehead forever, it means shelo yasiach dato mimenu, that it should be on his mind whenever he's wearing it. He should realize, hey, I'm wearing God's name. So then, tefillin, the tefillin that we wear, sheyesh behem azkarot arbeh, God's name is mentioned many times in the tefillin that we wear, al achat kama v'chama, how much more so, we have to be careful not to forget we're wearing tefillin. Hilkach mitkal dachilu, so you'll always remember you're wearing tefillin, you won't come to carrying them on Shabbos in public domain. So this is an interesting Gemara. Do you guys think about your tefillin when you're wearing them? The nature of a person is the first few times he thinks about it, and then you get used to it, you forget you're wearing tefillin. Right? So, what does this Gemara teach us? You're supposed to remember it. To what degree? So, we rule, halachically, that the idea that we have to remember the tefillin is that we shouldn't do things that are disrespectful with the tefillin. Meaning, you shouldn't be cracking jokes. You shouldn't, you're not allowed to go to the bathroom with tefillin on, right? We all know that. But there's an element of respect where a person shouldn't be light-headed with his tefillin. It doesn't mean that every second you have to think, ooh, my tefillin are on me, my tefillin are on me. How could you focus on your Shema? Right? How could you focus on your Shemona Esrei if that's what you're thinking all the time? So the answer is that it's a certain balance. On the one hand, I'm thinking other things. On the other hand, I realize there's a certain respect, a certain decorum I have to maintain because in some respect, I'm wearing God's name on me. So from here we learn that you're allowed to wear it even Friday afternoon, you won't come to forget. You know, the Jerusalem Talmud, out here in Jerusalem, the custom was, they'd wear it until Shabbos, and then when Friday afternoon, as the sun was setting, they'd take off their tefillin and make a blessing as they took it off. You know, we don't wear tefillin until the nighttime, and we don't make a blessing when we conclude mitzvot, but in Jerusalem they did. So they would wear it till the night, and then they take it off. You guys know the famous story of Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus? His son was coming in and he was on his deathbed and he told his son, go light candles, the sun's setting. And the kid said to the rabbis, I think my father's gone mad because it's almost Shabbos and he didn't take off his tefillin. He's sitting there with his tefillin on and he's telling me to go light candles. And I came in to help him take off his tefillin. So Rabbi Eliezer from the other room yelled at him and said, don't tell me I went mad, you went mad. Taking off tefillin isn't biblically prohibited on Shabbos, and lighting candles is. I told you to light candles because that's more incumbent upon you to get that done before the sun sets than taking off my tefillin. But you see, even Rabbi Eliezer, who was on his deathbed, that's the level the rabbis were on in those days, he was lying there with his tefillin on. It was an obvious thing that God-fearing people always wore their tefillin. We don't do it anymore. We're not on that level. But they did. Yes.
Less control over his body and bodily functions and things like that. You figure that maybe that like blessing from heaven or something, but it should kind of be allowed to be able to wear its tefillin during that time. But it seems so imminently
dead. Like, what if he Hashem died while he's wearing
tefillin?
Then, like, would the tefillin
have
could be like
problematic? Like, then they're like
suddenly
transported to a place of like intense tamar or something.
Like
that.
No, they'd be
tamay,
but that's it. Okay.
Yeah. So you can take off tefillin once already Shabbat. You can touch it. Or
yeah, that's an excellent question. Rav Yosef Karo wasn't certain about that. We technically assume it is muktzeh, but it's not so clear why. Like, which muktzeh is it? So we generally treat tefillin as muktzeh, but it's not so obvious that tefillin are really muktzeh. And when necessary, we do move them.
So
if a person is traveling and he sees tefillin lying out in the field, so he wears them and takes them into town. He doesn't leave them there for the animals to eat.
Okay.
Yeah, so you see, it's not that mukta. It's a middle ground mukta. And when necessary, we deal with it.
So you can't take it off if it's already Shabbat off your head?
If it's on his head, yeah. But ideally, you should do it beforehand. Yes. Tanya, Hanani omer chayav dam mashmesh bevegdo erev Shabbat im chashecha. Hanani taught a person should fill his pockets Friday afternoon. Why? Because maybe you're carrying things and you'll go into the public domain carrying things. I do it to make sure I don't have a pen on me. Very often I'll be in shul and suddenly I'll go, oh boy, I'll take out a pen or something and I'll go put it away. I try to do it before we accept Shabbos, right?
What if you find it after early? Like, what if you're walking in Zohar, you've been Shabbat for a while and you realize in your jacket pocket or in your pants pocket or something there's like a sheka or something?
So I think that that's okay because technically you're not interested in touching it. You know, the fact that it's sitting there is not your interest, assuming you're not where there's a public domain, you're not in Brooklyn or something. So then it's only the issue of Muktzeh. And for the issue of Muktzeh, technically you're walking. You're not interested in moving the coin from here to there.
Are you allowed to just take it out and put it down or throw it away or something?
So I don't think so. I think that while you're wearing the pants, it's okay. The issue is more how you take off the pants and where you'd put it when you took off the pants. Like, so long as you're wearing it, that's okay. You're not supposed to touch Muktzeh directly. The only permission you'd have to touch Muktzeh directly is for certain types of Muktzeh, Letzorech Gufo and Letzorech Mekomo. If you needed that penny, let's say you had a tuna fish can, right? But you needed to unscrew a screw in order to open the tuna fish can. You wanted to eat the tuna fish can, and the gimmick on top was the type of thing where you needed to stick in a coin and turn it in order to open the can, yeah? Let's say they locked it. They have gimmicks like that, where they lock it, and you got to stick in like a screwdriver or a coin and turn it, and then it'll open for you, yeah?
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about? There are all kinds of... you have bathrooms like that. Sometimes you have bathrooms where if a kid locks himself in the bathroom and you want to unlock it from the outside, so the stall has a slat in the lock, and you, if you stick in a screwdriver or a coin, you could turn it to unlock it, right? So let's say you needed the coin for that. You needed Letzorech Gufo. You wanted to use the physical coin as something to unscrew to unlock the door, right? So that you could do. Let's say you needed a hammer to open your nuts on Shabbos. That you could do, right? Let's say you needed scissors to open your bag of milk, right? Assuming you do that on Shabbos. So that you could do, even though scissors are mukta. They're kli shem lechtoli sur. They're used for prohibited things. But for that, it would be mutter. A coin might be more stringent because a coin is not only, I don't know if we'd call it a kli, and I don't know if you'd say melachta leser, or it's something which you have zero use for on Shabbos. But here, you have a different situation. So that's tzorch gufo, and then you have tzorch mekomo, if you need the place. Meaning, if you want to sit down and... you left the, let's say, cell phone is a bad example. Let's say you left your hammer on the dining room table. You were fixing things up, and comes Shabbos, and now the hammer is sitting on the place. You want to put down your challahs there. So for that, you can move the hammer to somewhere else, wherever you want. You know, but the coin, I don't know what we would treat, how we would treat coins today. I have to get back to you on that. Okay, back to, yeah.
So what if you find yourself carrying something that's not mukta, so what do you do in that case?
In public domain or regular?
Yeah.
In public domain. So that depends a little bit of how you walked and where you stopped. Meaning, let's say you live in Brooklyn, and you walked out of the house, and you're walking in public domain, and suddenly you realize you have in your pocket a candy. Okay, so the candy is not mukta, but you're not allowed to carry it on Shabbos. Technically, you only completed the biblical prohibition when you stopped. So long as you're in motion, you didn't complete the prohibition. So if you could walk right back into the place you came out of without stopping, technically that would probably be the best thing, because then you undid everything you did, so long as you didn't stop in the interim. If, let's say, you walked out of your house to the public domain, you walked to Coney Island Avenue, and you stood on the corner waiting for the light to change. So now you stopped, so taking it out from private domain into public domain, you did. Now the light turns green and you start walking and suddenly you feel that you have a candy in your pocket. So now you have a problem because you've lifted in public domain and you've transported it 4 footsteps in public domain and you don't know exactly where to go back and bring it back to the place where you started, right? So then and you already walked 4 footsteps, you already transferred it 4 amos. So then I think the best thing you could do is put it down on a mailbox, because a mailbox or a fire hydrant is a makom ptur. That's a place that's undefined. It's like a place within the public domain that's not public and not private. It's a place that in halacha is undefined. And then that would constitute lifting it, transporting, and then you never really put it down in the public domain. So you never completed the biblical prohibition. I think that would be the best option. Okay. So, yes?
I was explaining the concept that the prohibition involves resting as you complete the journey. So in which case, if you stopped at a stoplight while you're waiting, or while you're waiting for the light to change across the street, this is not prohibited because you're staying there, but you're not actively resting from the on the trip. Maybe if you sat down on a bench or something, maybe that sounds like it'd be a bit problematic. So literally, you have to, if you were to stop there at the stoplight, but you're saying you'd have to like walk around.
No, that's an interesting point. The Gemara's angle is, the Gemara says there's a difference between Amad Lafush and Amad Letaken Masoy. Meaning the Gemara says what you said. The Gemara says, if you stood, you took a pile of wood out of your house, and then you started walking, and then you paused to rearrange the wood on your shoulder. So that, the Gemara says, that's not called stopping, because that's part of your commute. You just stood to rearrange it. When is it called that you stopped? When you stopped, lafush, you stopped to rest. So you're right, the Gemara does say that. I never thought to say that stopping at a light is like stopping to rearrange your load, but I see the logic in what you're saying. You're saying maybe stopping at a light is part of my walk. I just can't walk. There's traffic going in front of me. Just like if the guy in front of me stops and I just wait for him to move so I could keep going. I didn't think of it that way, but that's a good point. I don't know. I have to look into that. It's a good point. I don't know. Is that called Amad Lesakein Maso? I don't know. Gotta look. I don't know. Okay. Back to our Gemara. So you guys gave me a lot of food for thought. Okay. I don't have a pen and paper to write it down, though. Okay, Tanu Avanan. If you could remind me at the end of the class, then maybe I'll get smarter, too. Hanechnas levaker tachole b'Shabbat. If someone goes in to visit someone who's sick on Shabbos, Omer, so what do you wish a guy on Shabbos? The poor guy is sick, what do you tell him? Shabbat imilizok, ufoa krova lavo. You tell him Shabbos is not a time where we make our personal requests. Shabbat imilizok. On Shabbos, Chazal did not want us to make requests over those that are ill, because Chazal realized that we might be sad on Shabbos. So Shabbat imi lizok. Shabbat isn't the time to really start davening about the sick. But nonetheless, we wish him that he gets healed. Does that line sound familiar to you? Where do we say that? Shabbat imi lizok. Ufua krova lavo. We say that in the Mishnah Berach. Right?
What does it mean?
Shabbat imi lizok. It is Shabbos, so we really refrain from wailing. We're not going to go crying now over the sick. But ufua krova lavo. Nonetheless, we wish him that he have a speedy recovery. Now, what's this whole idea of Mishnah Berach? Why do we make Mishnah Berach for the sick? So the Talmud tells us in Tractate Baba Kama that if you have someone sick in your home, what's the segula? How do they get healthy? What's the segula? We live in a generation that everyone looks for segulas. Give me an amulet. So the Talmud says, go to your local Orthodox rabbi. Interesting. It doesn't say, go out to Uman or something else. It says, go to your local Orthodox rabbi and ask him to daven on your behalf. And that's black and white in the Gemara. And the Ramah over here in the Laws of Shabbos quotes that. And the Ramah says, this is why we make a Mishnah Berach. What we're doing in a Mishnah Berach is an exchange. We're saying, he who blessed our forefathers should bless and heal. this person, and that's why when we make a mishaberch, when we pray for the sick, we say this same line. Shabbati mi lizok ufako valavo. It's Shabbos, really we don't want to go crying on Shabbos, but nonetheless, we wish him a speedy recovery.
So what does that mean practically? You're not allowed to pray with great fervor and tears and all that on Shabbat for someone, but you're allowed to wish him Rafo Shema, like if you see
right. Right. Very good, yeah. Rabbi Meir Omer Yechola Ishet Rachem. Rabbi Meir says what we tell him is, you know, Shabbos has within its potency to have mercy over you. If you honor Shabbos, don't worry about your troubles too much. Try to honor the Shabbos. So then Shabbos itself can have mercy over you. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda says what we wish him is, HaMakom Yerachem Alecha V'al Cholei Yisrael. The omnipresent should have mercy over you and all the ill people in Israel. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rabbi Yossi modifies that with one word, HaMakom Yerachem Alecha B'toch Cholei Yisrael. May God have mercy over you amongst those that are ill in Israel. So here we have that concept, that when we pray for someone, we're praying for him as a part of a greater whole. And in a second, the Gemara will expand on that. But first, the Gemara quotes an opinion of a rabbi named Shevna. Who remembers who Shevna was? We learned about him in our Yeshaya class, in our class in Isaiah. We learned about Shevna. So Shevna was an interesting character. There was a man named Shevna Asher Alabayit. Shevna was one of the King Chizkiyahu's advisors. He was in charge. He was like the chief butler. And at the time when Sanherib brought the Assyrian forces to the gates of Jerusalem, so Shevna amassed a rebellion against Chizkiyahu. And Shevna had a larger number of citizens on his side than did Chizkiyahu. And Shevna came along and said, we are going to give the city over to the Assyrian Empire. We don't stand a chance. This King Chizkiyahu, he's so humble. He's always wearing, he eats small meals. He's so modest and pious. That's not the stuff a king should be made out of. Shevna would sit down and have his steaks and drink tons of wine. And he'd say, you know, I'm fit to be king. I'm going to be among the Davidic dynasty, that's where I'll get buried. And Chizkiyahu saw that he was outnumbered. And he saw that the masses sided with Shevna. So he didn't know what to do. And God sent the prophet and told Chizkiyahu, don't worry, it ain't going to happen. So Chizkiyahu said, yeah, but I'm outnumbered. Maybe when they pray, you'll listen to them. God said, no, kesher reshaim eno min haminyan. I don't count the wicked. When they cast their ballots don't count. Yeah, even though they're the greater number, they don't have a vote. Kesher reshaim eno min haminyan, a party of wicked people doesn't get counted. Just because they have a larger number doesn't interest me. And what happens next is that Shevna sends word to the Assyrian king Sanherib. He says, tomorrow I'm coming out with my troops and we're going to give over the city in your hands. And he prepares his thousands of men and he goes out of the city, he has them open the gates, he goes out of the city, and God has the gate clang shut behind him. So the rest of his troops try to come out, and they can't, the gate's sealed. And he tries to go back in, he can't, the gate's sealed. So he's outside Jerusalem, and all his men are inside Jerusalem. And he sees he can't get back in, so he doesn't know what to do. He advances to the Assyrian front. The soldiers rush towards him and nab him. And he says, wait, I have a deal with the king. He's expecting me. So they bring him to the king. And the king says, right, you sent us a letter. You're bringing us the troops. Very nice. Where are the troops? So he says, well, your honor, your majesty, there's been a problem. I had all the troops set up. And you wouldn't believe what happened on my way out. You know, the gates clang shut behind me and only I came. So the king says, you're right, there is a problem. You promised me you're giving me the whole city, and only you came. You're making fun of me? He ordered his soldiers to tie Shevna to the tails of horses and have those horses ride through the desert throughout the thorns, and Shevna's body was torn to pieces, and that's how he died. And Shevna is one example in Jewish history of a tremendously wicked Jew. He tried to give over the city of Jerusalem against the king, against Chizkiyahu. So Tosfos over here asks, How could there be a rabbi named Shevna? Shevna is the name of a person who was extremely wicked in Jewish history. We don't use wicked people's names. That's like calling one's son Nimrod. Some say you shouldn't call your son Omri. Omri was a wicked king. He set up paganism in Israel. So, Tosfos answers. We see in that same time period, the Navi Isaiah speaks about two Shevnas. So the time that you can't use the name of someone wicked is when he alone is known by that name. But when you had more than one person in that period in history who had that name, so then you could use that name. In Shevna's time, there were two Shevnas. One was the Shevna who was a pious person. He was a scribe. So that's why you could use the name. So this is an important Tosos. People want to use all kinds of names for their kids. So Tosos here gives us the rule. Shevna ish Yerushalayim. He tells us, b'chnisato omer, when you enter to visit the sick person, what you say is, shalom. Uvitziato. And when you exit, what you say is, shabbatim irizok ufoak ovalavo. It's Shabbos, we're not going to go wailing. And yet, we wish you a speedy recovery. V'rachamav merubim, God's mercy is plentiful. V'shivtu v'shalom. And you guys should rest in peace. You should have a peaceful Shabbos. Now, the older I get, the more I understand how important this is. I can't remember a month that I haven't seen someone go by ambulance to the hospital on Shabbos. You know, one of the hardest times for someone who's ill is Shabbos. They don't have easy access to nurses or medical care, anything else. So, we wish them shivtu b'shalom, the Shabbos should pass in peace. Now the Gemara concludes and says, we have a rule here which also we quote in Halacha. Rabbi Chanina taught, whenever you're praying for someone ill, include him with the masses. That's like Rabbi Yossi, right? Rabbi Yossi said, pray he should have a speedy recover among the rest of the sick. And that's how we always pray, right? You guys noticed in the Misha Berach, that's how we pray in davening, Rifa'enu. We ask for healing among the rest. So what did we learn today? Who remembers? We began with the story of the fat goat. Remember the fat calf. Right? Rabbi Shua Breid Rav Idi came to Rav Ashi's house. They made him this big fat calf. And he said, sorry, I'm fasting. They said, why don't you push off your fast and eat? And he said, I can't. It's a fast over a bad dream. And we said, you fast over a bad dream the next morning, even if it's Shabbos. Then we said, you can walk around with tefillin because you won't forget it, right? Just like the tzitz, you can't forget you're wearing tefillin. Then we said you should check your clothing as Shabbos settles in. And then we went over to the discussion, how do you visit the sick on Shabbos? What do you wish them? And we concluded with this idea that whenever praying for the sick, we include them among the rest of the sick. We don't just pray for so-and-so, we say so-and-so among the rest of the ill in Am Yisrael. Any questions? Okay.